It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
His name is Frank Galvin. 4 cases in the last 3 years. He's lost them all. He drinks. This man's scared to death to go to court.
Frankie, listen to me, because I'm done with you. I got you a good case. It's a moneymaker.
The Archdiocese called up because the case is coming to trial.
This is our chance to get away.
I'm going to see that you get that chance. Court exists to give him a chance at justice.
And is that what you're going to do?
Maybe I can do something right.
It's a generous offer, Mr. Galvin.
I just heard someone offer you 200 grand.
When I walk out that door, the offer is withdrawn.
What are you, nuts?
I can win it. I can win this case.
But what are you going to do?
I need your help.
To do what?
They killed her. I'm trying to buy it.
I said to you, know what you did?
No, did. Jeez, take it easy. Okay. Now.
And I got to find out from the other side that they offered $200,000.
I can subpoena you, you know.
Well, maybe you just better do that then.
I had a witness disappear on me, Your Honor. You should have taken their offer. I have no sympathy for you.
We're going to lose.
Listen, the damn case doesn't start before tomorrow, and already it's over for you.
It is over.
I can't invest in failure, Frank, anymore.
Pushing into court 5 days early, I lose my star witness, and I can't get a continuance, and I don't care. I'm going up there, I'm going to try it, I'm going to let the jury decide.
All right!
Hear ye, all persons having anything to do before the Honorable, the Justices of the Superior Court, now sitting at Boston, within and for the County of Suffolk. Draw near, give your attendance, and you shall be heard.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? I'm Paul Spitero, and I am joined, once again, by my good buddy, Mr. Sean Whalen.
It's a pleasure to be here today, buddy.
It's a pleasure to be on with you. We, you know, there's been no interruption in the show. Every other week we have an episode, but it has been a little while since we recorded. I had a vacation, we had some stuff going on, and it's good to get back on with you.
Yeah, I went on vacation too. I mean, it's been, it feels like it's been a long stretch. So I'm not used to this. It's good. It's good to be back.
Yeah, absolutely. So today we are taking a look at The Verdict from 1982, the Paul Newman film. And I saw this in the movies back in 1982. I really enjoyed it then. I've seen it multiple times since then. And quite frankly, every time I see it, I say, my God, I forgot how good this movie is. I think this is, I'm not going to bury the lead. I think this is a great movie. And we'll talk about it more in depth. But what's your quick take?
I've never seen this before, which is unusual for me. You know, it's this movie had a lot of buzz around. It's Paul Newman. The cast, and by the way, I should say the cast in general is a stellar cast. So this is a movie that should have been seen by me in the theater, at the very least, on cable, you know, because, you know, 82, we're talking about the, you know, the height of cable. That's where you saw movies if you didn't catch them in the theater. I don't know how I've missed this one. So when you threw out a list of like, oh, these are some potential movies, this was one of the first ones you threw out. And I was like, oh, I've always wanted to see this. So I've watched it twice. And the reason why is just because I didn't want my opinion to be driven by the first viewing, if that makes sense. With these, if I haven't seen it before, I try to see it at least twice before we do these conversations, yeah, just to make sure. But yeah, this one, it's going to be a fun one to talk about. New car smell, I think it was. When Scott was on the one episode, I think you and Scott were talking about new car smell for a film. And I try to watch them twice to avoid that. I mean, obviously, it's still fresh, but at least the second viewing, it's, you know what's going to happen, so you can analyze it as a movie. And I think there's a lot to talk about the makeup of this movie, like how it was constructed, because I think there's a lot of things in this that it did that are unique. It didn't lean into some of the window dressing that other movies do and should appropriately do. This one stayed very clean and grounded, and I think it needed to. And in particular, sound. I think we're talking about music and sound and soundtrack and things like that. I think there's so much to discuss about how this film was constructed and what it was like to follow these characters, that I think this one's going to be a fun conversation.
Yeah, I think so too. And I'm going to piggyback on what you said about the acting. I think everyone in this movie, everyone with no exception, is either a great actor or stepped up and gave a great performance.
Yes.
I think the acting is just phenomenal in this movie. So I'm going to give some credit to just the quality of the actors, and I will also give credit to Sidney Lumet for getting the best performances out of everybody. I think I'm going to, like I said, I'm not going to bury the lead. I'm going to just be fawning over this movie from beginning to end. I just think every aspect of it is pretty much top notch. I'm going to start with Paul Newman. Now, my understanding is that there were several people that were connected to this production, including Roy Scheider, William Holden, Frank Sinatra, Dustin Hoffman, Robert Redford, and in particular, I heard Cary Grant really wanted to play this part. I could see every one of them doing a good job with it. I don't see any one of them, not one, doing the performance that Paul Newman did. And I think I can just kind of break it down a little bit. I have at times dismissed Paul Newman's acting ability and instead fell upon, well, he's, you know, a very, very good looking man, you know, with those blue eyes and all of that. And he's got a hell of a lot of charisma. And that carries him through a lot of his performances. But the reality is, he broke it down in this movie, and he didn't rely on those things. There was an aspect of it where I think that became very important, and I'll touch on that in a moment. But on a whole, he showed some inner conflict and thoughts and things that were going on, a lot of which was unsaid, a lot of which was just in his mannerisms and the looks that he gave. That I said back in 1982 when I was not fancying myself as a as an online film critic. I said back then that I thought he was ripped off for the Oscar because I thought this was certainly the Oscar-winning performance. And I think it was the Oscar-winning performance of his career. And I've always had a little bit of an issue with the fact that he won it for The Color of Money, which is kind of a part that I don't think required anywhere near as much exposing himself, if you will. I think that this is the performance of his career, and it was Oscar worthy. And the fact that the Academy Award went to Ben Kingsley for a movie that I loathe, Gandhi, and I have no problem with Ben Kingsley, but I do have a problem with that movie. I think that movie was horrible. I just think it was an absolute travesty. I looked at who was nominated this particular year. It was Dustin Hoffman for Tootsie, excellent performance. Ben Kingsley for Gandhi, probably excellent. I'm just so down on that movie that I can't even really put it together. Jack Lemmon for Missing, that's the one I never saw. I remember hearing about it at the time. I think I saw it on Siskel and Ebert or whatever, and it seemed so depressing that I just kind of avoided it and still haven't seen it to this day, so I can't say. Peter O'Toole for My Favorite Year. I like that movie a lot. I like his performance a lot, but I do think that's one that's based on charm and charisma more than any sort of depth of acting. And then you got Paul Newman for The Verdict. To me, it's no contest. As much as good as some of those performances are, I think Paul Newman should have walked away with it, you know, in a landslide.
Here's what makes it an amazing performance. And I'm going to make some weird comparisons, and just you'll have to forgive me for this. But when you take a look at, let's use Jaws for an example, just because, is it Jaws, right? Roy Scheider is not Roy Scheider in that movie. At a certain point in time, you get transported into what's going on in the film. He becomes the lead character. This is going to seem like a real weird out there comparison, but Harrison Ford, when he's Han Solo and when he's in Indiana Jones, I do not blur those two. He transports me. Michael J. Fox is Marty McFly. I think there's actors at a certain point in time, and this is, again, weird comparison with The Verdict, but there became, it was very, very early in the film, and I think it had to do with the way that it opened. It felt different. It didn't have your traditional soundtrack opening. It was him. We got a chance to. It was very, very like a quiet kind of scene where we got transported into the first foray into who this character is. He started very, very quickly as we started getting to know him, becoming Frank Galvin. And there was not a point in time in my first or second viewing that I was thinking this is Paul Newman until afterwards, where I was like, man, did Paul Newman do a great job in this? The character was fully realized and felt very, very human. And the trick with him is he is not this perfect character. He's not this suave leading man. He is a very human individual. He comes with a skill set. He comes with some passions. He also comes with a lot of mistakes and a lot of baggage that you see throughout this. I thought it was really cool. I was reading some of the trivia pieces from this. The eye drop thing that he does, you know, because of the fact that he's trying to hide the fact that he's been doing some drinking. That was a Paul Newman idea, is my understanding from what the director said in one of the commentaries. That's an actor who is embracing the character, trying to add some realism to the character, trying to transport us to a place. I was completely transported with this character and captivated twice in a very short period of time, because it's a time investment with this film, because it's a big story. And I wanted to watch it a second time, not just because I felt I had to, because I really enjoyed it. I enjoyed hanging out with Frank, and it felt very, very grounded. I'm going to keep referencing the sound choices in this one as being something that I think is a highlight in this film. The fact that we did not have the obligatory like soundtrack running the way that you traditionally do in a film like this, I think was an amazing choice. It was a bold choice. A lot of times we're driven by having that powerful soundtrack that creates emotion. In this case, a lot of what they did here was let the story, let sound effects, let making an environment come to life in a very realistic way take this film. And I think the acting talent in this really carried this film with quality performances that made you feel like you were really watching a courtroom drama unfold. If you're watching this on the news, you're not getting a soundtrack in the background. You are watching it live. You are seeing it unfold. You are being pulled into the gripping drama that's going on. I loved the fact that we got to see him both in the courtroom and out of the courtroom as a very real, fully realized person. The acting talent in this did not need any help. The story and their performances just carried us through this whole thing, and it felt very grounded. I felt like I was hanging out with them in all of the right ways. And at times I wanted to smack them upside the head, where it was like, get it together. I want you to win this. There's some evil people involved in all of this. And I loved how we got to like go on that journey with them. And I feel like I constantly was rooting for Frank, even though Frank at times has problems. And it's such a good thing.
I think it's in my opinion, it's almost a little bit beyond that he has problems. He is a very flawed individual.
Yes.
And I think that's where Paul Newman kind of allowed his veneer to be broken in this and to be presented as somebody who has problems. I mean, he's an alcoholic. He is, I mean, the movie starts off with him being despicable. He's going to funerals, trying to sign up cases of people he doesn't know, pretending that he was friends with the deceased person. You know, it's beyond an ambulance chaser. It's a hearse chaser. I mean, it's really, you know, he's doing something despicable. He punches a woman in this movie. I mean, there are things about him that you would just naturally say, I don't like this character.
Yeah.
And yet his performance brings through something that makes you root for him despite this. Now, part of that, I think, is if you want the audience to root for somebody who's not necessarily a good guy, you have to give him somebody to go up against who's in his own way worse than him.
Yeah.
And we do that in here, and we do it in a very, very intelligent and well-written way, because I mean, we have James Mason, who is just an unbelievable actor, and he's presented not necessarily as a total villain, but a guy who's willing to cut some corners and do some things that he probably shouldn't do and put some roadblocks up, you know, in front of Frank Galvin that are not exactly ethical. So you can root against him because you're also feeling bad for this woman in the hospital who's brain dead. You know, and we have a chance to visit with her almost, you know, kind of. So you you root for him for that. Then you have Charlotte Rampling, another great performance in this. And I don't really know her from anything but this. I don't think I've ever seen her in anything else. But she's another one where, you know, she's doing something, which we eventually find out with the reveal, that makes her into a villain. But both of those characters are fully realized. They're not just mustache twirling villains. You know, she clearly falls in love with him as this goes on. She actually gives him a pep talk at one point that keeps him going when he probably, you know, when he was ready to give up. So there's complex characters, complex relationships, and it's all presented in a very, very realistic way.
What was great about her is she was fully realized too. So you wound up loving her the way that he did. I loved the way that they dressed her up in this, where she looks beautiful, but they didn't go over the top, if that makes sense. Like, she was grounded as well. You see why he was drawn to her. It was not only that she's beautiful, but also the fact that she's intelligent. She brings a lot to the table. She's engaging. She helps. She genuinely seems interested in helping him. And this, where we get to see her be incredibly flawed, you know, when she took, what was it, $575 or something like that, you know, at that point in time, there may have been more money involved along the way, but we're still talking about 1982 and her trying. It wasn't just the money, it was getting back into the legal arena. And obviously with James Mason's group, this is a big time operation. So, you know, being able to have that kind of backing hopefully will, you know, help open doors for her. But the crying that she was doing at that time was not overdone, not over the top. You could see that she was caught between the, I'm getting what I want, but at a cost. And is the cost too high? And that's very real. I'm glad that that was never expressly said by her. Like, they didn't do the traditional scene where you have to do it, where now she has a redemption story. That didn't happen. What happened was we got to see, again, the evidence of what she did and then the after effects of it, that this impacted her and that she was trying to make it right, trying to have conversations with them. And I loved that they did not do the, we've got to, like, these two are going to wind up together or forgiving each other at the end. They didn't do that. And that's, I think, where there's a brilliance to this movie and a reality to this movie. Something that big is going to have consequences. She was sabotaging him along the way by the fact that she was revealing information, and he only managed to get the victory at the end by the skin of his teeth. And that felt very real. And you're really counting on the jury to do the right thing based on what had been put before them. I loved that that was not clean. It was not a slam dunk. I think we as the viewer, especially the first time through, you know, are hoping the jury's going to do the right thing, but with certain testimony being stricken, what are they going to do with that? I loved all of that piece, and I think it added to the flavor with her and what they did with her and him that separates it from a traditional love story. I totally got them together as a couple. I felt terrible that they weren't going to wind up there. There's a possibility that somewhere in the far future, maybe there's a conversation to be had there. I don't know. You know, sometimes you go too far, and that's real too. I loved that. I loved that about her performance. I thought she was great. Grounded. Again, grounded. Nothing in this was like beyond realistic. And even his reaction where he made that mistake, you referenced her getting smacked. I think that was very powerful because you're sitting there again saying, Frank is you. Frank goofed. You know, and when I say goof, big time, that's a big time move. You don't do that. But you get the emotion that drove Frank to that. Not justifying it. You get why Frank was in that place. And that's something that was so good. The drama between the two of them. If you don't have that acting talent there, none of this makes sense. Every moment made sense. Every moment.
I am loath to say this, but when he hit her, I didn't sit there and say, well, that's wrong. He shouldn't have done that. Mm-hmm. I felt she earned that, honestly. And it's a terrible thing. But, you know, we do talk about equality between men and women. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I guess the reality is, even if a man had done it, you're not supposed to punch him in the face either.
Right.
So from that perspective, I can sit here and I could say, yeah, it's wrong. He shouldn't have done it. There's other ways to let your displeasure be known and whatever. But where, you know, if he had punched a man in the face for doing something of a similar nature, for betraying him, you know, if Jack Warden's character had betrayed him and he punched him, you would accept it and it wouldn't be a problem. In this case, I accept it and it's not a problem. I'm not saying it's right, but I don't think it's despicable the way normally I would if, you know, with a man hitting a woman.
Here's what I think we would have done in both of those cases. And I think there's a reality of that as friends, we're running with Frank as friends, right? And that's why we feel that way. In this film, you've got to be, you're Frank's buddies. At the end of the day, I think in both cases you're referencing, as the friends, we would have said, I totally get why you felt the way that you did. Probably shouldn't have punched him. Probably shouldn't have smacked him.
Yeah. But I'll accept that. I'm not sitting here justifying the punch in itself.
No. And I get that. I'm more supporting you than disputing you. I think, you know, what you do when you see those situations, you go, do you get why he was in that place? And I think in both circumstances that you're referencing, with what was on the line for him and where he's been, he was doing everything he could to take an ethical approach to this, because he could have taken the money and ran, you know, and that's the key story with Frank. He sits there and realizes there's something wrong here. Like, there's certain comments about ambulance chasers and things like that that were being made along the way where he's like, is this all that I am? And I loved that aspect of the film, because you're seeing a guy who is trying to be something more than what he has been. At some point in time, I'm getting the idea that, you know, way back in the day, he went in this for all the right idealistic reasons that you would head down this career path, and circumstance changed him along the way. And he's coming back, and not clean, not perfect at the end. I'm not like sitting here going, wow, he's not flawed at all anymore. Nah, he still is. But the difference was, when you see him go through those circumstances where he was betrayed, you get it. I'm also kind of like, if he were to ask me, should I take the phone call? I'm strangely in the place where you may want to at least talk to her.
Well, I kind of feel like
a weird thing. I mean, it's I kind of feel like
it's a bookend in the movie, though. Like it opens up with him playing on the pinball machine, and it's almost like that's his escape. He's getting away from life, and he's getting away from his responsibilities and all that. And he's hit pretty much rock bottom. And then as the movie goes on, he lifts himself up out of that bottom, and he finally gets above it. And just as a little bit of an interlude in that, between the scene when he takes the pictures of the comatose girl in the hospital and when he turns down the settlement offer, it's a slow realization. It's not like just a light switch went on. It's a slow realization where he realizes this is his opportunity to rise above where he's been and to do the right thing, in his opinion, even though he does it in the wrong, unethical way by not advising his clients of the offer, which is absolutely improper, and he could get disbarred for that. But that's besides the point. But by the end of the movie, he's now no longer in rock bottom. It's not he's a perfect character, and it's not like he's not going to have issues in life, but he's finally risen above it all. And he's at least on the right path now. And I feel like that phone ringing was almost a chance to fall back into codependency and to go back to where he was. Mm-hmm. So that his not answering it is, I'm beyond this now. I'm no longer at this level. That's the way I interpreted that.
I loved it. I loved that it was multiple calls and multiple rings where he was, and you saw him. When you talk about whether or not he's a great actor, there was so much told by his visual reaction and hers to that whole sequence. There was no dialogue associated. It was them acting. We got to see it visually from them. They told a story with facial expressions, what they did and what they didn't do. Nothing was wooden about that sequence at all, which I think is just really, really brilliant. It was a bold choice, I think, to close out a film. Because like I said, there's certain tropes that I think we traditionally expect, you know, like, oh, there should be some kind of stronger ending to this, you know, what they're, you know, there should be a fight between them or, you know, hacking it out and they get back together. This film was so much better because they didn't do that. And I think you're right on how you're analyzing it. And I think that's what I think is magical about this film is the fact that it's allowing itself to be a unique story that I think feels much more realistic than a lot of movies allow themselves to be. And that's where when you've got flawed human beings, real human beings, it does not end clean all the time. Even though he had a victory lap that we all got to see, it did not end clean. And I loved that. I love when a movie's not afraid to have a little dirt under the fingernails. And this one was not afraid to do that. It's very, very different from that respect.
Yeah, and you know what? I missed something too when I talked about the villains that he's up against in this, and how could I possibly leave out Milo O'Shea? I mean, he is just—he's wonderful in this. He's so despicable and so hateable, and yet there are aspects of him, having been in courtrooms for many years. I never handled a case of anything of this level, but having been in conferences with Judge, the point when he turns to him and he just says, Frank, what'll it take to have you turn and walk away now? You know, like what amount will it be? Feels very real. When he starts talking about, well, it's so complex that, you know, how are you going to, if it's so complex, how do you expect the jury to understand it? That's a comment I've heard from judges on many occasions. There's, you know, it feels very, very real. I got to think, the screenwriter on this was David Mamet, who is famous for his scripts and his dialogue. But I got to think he did some legwork into, courtroom feel and all of that, because there's a lot of the dialogue that's very real. Now, I did question, and I'm jumping around, I know, here. Mm-hmm. When the judge makes the ruling to exclude Caitlin Costello Price's testimony, mm-hmm. I think that would not only potentially, I think that screams out that it would be subject to an appeal if Frank had lost the case. And it even goes the other way, that the defense can make a motion and potentially an appeal saying the verdict is against the weight of the evidence if that exclusion was proper. I don't think the exclusion was proper. I think I don't know the case that they cite. I can't comment on that. If that case is correct, then there's a possibility he could get upheld on keeping the document out. But her testimony is what her testimony is. There was never even a moment where they actually offered that document into evidence. So, right. You know, there's procedural things that we don't have before us here. But I do think the plaintiff would win on getting that document in, because it's not being presented as this is the final document. In fact, it's being presented as this is what it was before they had me change it. So there's a definite basis for it. It's not just two copies of the same thing. And they're saying, oh, one is, you know, that there's just a difference. It's to back up her testimony that they forced her to change it. And even without that document, you still have her testimony. And there's no reason that was absolutely there to rebut the testimony that the form said 9 hours. So there's aspects of that I think were certainly questionable. But then I can take it from there and say, when all was said and done, the diocese wanted this case to go away with as little publicity as possible. So because of that, even with the verdict being in excess of what they were asking for, which we never find out what the final amount is, they might be looking to just, hey, you know what, get this thing off the radar, get it out of the news, and we don't want to, you know, we don't want to appeal it because we don't want to cause further focus on it. We want it to be in the rearview mirror as soon as possible.
Backing you up 100% is that scene with the bishop where the bishop was asking, but do you believe this happened? Do you believe, you know, I mean, he was, and I'm poorly paraphrasing it, but he was asking that question in the later sequence where, you know, but what do you believe? Like, and the way that whole scene, that scene had the right amount of screen time, and you didn't need like this long exposition of an answer. You didn't need anything out of that. You just needed him asking the question, because it validates exactly what you're saying, which is what we knew from the beginning. Your point, there's a lot of proper bookending in this film, and I think that was another example. I thought he played, it was Edward Binns, played the bishop. I thought he played a good role in this, and I thought those sequences when he came in were key, because, you know, you don't want to at the end be going, I don't think he was a bad man. I think he was trying to be an appropriate leader. And I think when he's asking the question, you see his ethics going, wait a minute, but let's ask the question right now. What do you think happened here? Do you think she was truthful in her testimony? Because now he's got to come back with what should be our reaction to this. And I love that at certain points in time in this, even with the judge, there came a point in time in the case where the judge, he clearly has no use for Frank. And I never felt that changed throughout the film, but I did feel like his stance on the case started to change in subtle ways. It wasn't like, you know, a flipping to the other side or anything like that. And I loved that reality where there were certain points in time where it's like, okay, Houston, we got a problem here. And I love that that vibe in the courtroom became a thing. It was everybody. It was the judge. It was the witnesses. It was James Mason. The whole courtroom vibe switched when she was on the stand. And I loved the fact that her performance was very subtle and nuanced. But everybody else around her contributed to that performance. Because of the fact that the courtroom changed, the dynamic changed, because she was a wild card. Yeah, they struck the testimony and all of that, but you can't unhear. No matter what the judge says, I wish you hadn't heard that. You can't unhear that. You just can't. It's going to impact you no matter what the judge says in that moment. And I loved the reality of that. It impacted everybody in the room.
There are times on trial when the attorney clearly asks a question that he knows will be subject to an objection that will be sustained. Mm-hmm. And the thought process is, the thought process is, but the jury will have heard the question and they'll know, they'll be able to piece that together and know where I'm going with it, whether the judge sustains the objection or not. So, yeah, I mean, that's a strategic thing that is not uncommon at all. To get something in front of a jury. In this case, that wasn't his strategy. His strategy wasn't, oh, I'm going to get it up there and it's going to get, eliminated. He fully thought that he was presenting the evidence that the jury was going to go with. So, there's, I guess, different levels on that. But, the courtroom stuff was very well played. I think they didn't do what we usually get in courtroom, where they present a summation and then they present the counter to the summation, and both of them are incredibly compelling. And I think in this case, that might be one of the very few things I might have changed, was to add, 3 minutes of film on this and make Frank Galvin's summation a little longer, and to have us hear Concannon's summation as well. I think that might have been a little bit more dramatic, if it's possible to be more dramatic than this movie was. I think it just would have been an enjoyable thing to have that. I don't know that it would have changed the overall feel of the movie at all, but I would have liked to have seen Concannon's summation.
Newman did his in one take.
I was reading that in the trivia section, and I was like, oh my gosh, because it was very powerful. And I think that was a bold choice for them to go, you know what, this, and I think it was a very good performance there. I agree with you that, like, there's so much more I would love to have seen just because I got so engrossed by this. So you're right that when you were like, I'm just like sitting here nodding along going, yeah, I would love that footage too. But I've got to say, I loved his closing statement, and the idea that Paul Newman was able to slam dunk that in one take. Says something about where he was at emotionally with this character.
Did you spot the cameo appearance of an actor to become famous later in the gallery?
Who was it? I didn't catch it.
You see him every once in a while. One time you see him sitting there behind Paul Newman. One time you see him sitting behind the plaintiff and her husband, Bruce Willis.
Oh, was he in there? Oh, that's cool.
It's before he was famous. This is before Moonlighting or anything like that. He was an extra, and he's sitting in the audience, and you see him, with a head of hair. I would never in a million years have spotted him, except I had heard that he's in it. And this time when we watched it, I was specifically looking for him, and I found him.
That's cool.
If you do a Google search of Bruce Willis, The Verdict, you could see they have screenshots of it too.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I thought that was very cool too. The legal stuff, there's a lot of the legal stuff that just goes by, and I understand that. This isn't a case that we're getting from Inception. This is a case we're getting. It's coming up for trial in 5 days, and here we are. It would be interesting to know, because they have depositions of the parties. It would be interesting to know how involved Frank Galvin was in the discovery process in this case. Wow. Did he conduct the depositions? Did Mickey, Jack Warden's character, conduct the depositions? Did they take the case from somebody else? How did this progress? And again, not from a drama point of view, but purely from I'm wondering how this all came, because he seemed so lax on the case when it began. He said something like, it's coming up in for trial, and have you even looked at the file yet? There's a lot there in reality. Again, having tried a good number of cases, I've been in a situation where, like, a case was coming on the trial calendar for Monday. So, on Monday, you're going to find out if you're picking a jury, and then you pick a jury. And then after you're done with that, a day or two later, you start trying the case. I rarely gave the full look at the file until we had an absolute definite date and it was coming up soon, because I was always concerned, well, if I prepped everything now, if I sat with the depositions and I went through them and I made my notes and I started preparing things, but the trial isn't coming up for another month and a half or 2 months, by the time it comes up, I'm not going to remember everything I did. And then I got to just redo it all. So I would wait until they said, okay, you know, tomorrow you're going out to pick a jury. And then I would do an all-nighter and get myself ready, because I needed it to be fresh in my mind when I did it. So, you know, I would know my case, which is more than Frank Galvin could say, but I wouldn't have the full workup done until it was ready to go. There's also just, you know, from my own personal perspective, opening arguments, I always did off the cuff. I didn't have anything prepared. I kind of had an idea of what the points were I wanted to make, which is a very important aspect of trial preparation. You need to know what the elements are and what you're going to prove, and you need to kind of hammer them through the trial. So I would know what elements I needed to hammer in my opening, but I would do it all off the top of my head, and I would rarely promise something beyond the basics, because sometimes you'd have a case where you think a witness is going to be on the stand and they don't show up. And sometimes you think a witness is going to say something, and then when they get on the stand, they say something that's a little different than what you think. So if you promise things in the opening, in summation, the other side can say, you heard Mr. Spataro. He said this is going to happen, and it never happened. And then, you know, that could be critical, that could kill you. So I never really gave too much away in my opening. I would just kind of start laying the groundwork for the law. But with summations, I would sit the night before and I would just plan it out, you know, in detail. And then I would have just a bullet point notation in front of me, because you can't sit there reading your summation. You have to do it regular. But I'd look at the bullet point. I'd know where I wanted to go with it, because I had run it over in my mind 100 times. And then I would just give each argument, bing, 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 bing. So, you know, that's me. That's how I handled it. And when I watched these things, it felt like he was doing it off the cuff. And I think that's more true to Frank Galvin's character. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the reasons I would have liked to have seen Concannon's, because I think Concannon was, between him and his crew of attorneys, he was always incredibly prepared. Yes. So I think his summation would have come off much more polished. And I think that would have been interesting to hear what the jury was going to hear from him. So I would have liked that. The one area, and it's just to kind of build on that before we move on to something else, the one area that I really liked is, as prepared as he was and as polished as he was so thrown off by Caitlin Costello's testimony that he didn't know where to go.
That is absolutely 1,000%. And I think that adds absolutely the exclamation point to everything you said about him having the team and being so polished. And I think that's where that performance was very nuanced as well. The fact that you could see it in his face, but he was also recognizing, and it shows that he's polished, that he was already working through, all right, I've got to do something about this. Because the problem was his witness was already falling apart. And he needed to gain control of the situation and was doing everything in his power to regain control, because if now the courtroom is getting out of control and he walked in because of his team with a game plan that was polished, ready to go. And he had, obviously because of the information he had a response to everything Frank was going to do. So now all of a sudden he didn't have that for this particular piece. And I loved how he didn't fall apart. It was very, very subtle what we got to see. And that's where these performances were, conservative is not the right word, but I thought they were very balanced. And, you know, they weren't over the top. You could go out of your way of being over the top with any of these performances. And I think it would have taken away from this realistic feel of the film. You would have felt it was actors trying to put on a performance. I did not. I felt these were real people. And that's key in something like this. And I think Concannon is a great example of when you get to see Concannon with his team and what's going on there. I think it added everything to what it looked like in the courtroom. and what we saw in the courtroom because of it. And I loved that part of it.
Totally agree. But you know, there was that, just that moment of indecision and flustered that he was when she said that she kept a copy. And he's like, why? Why would you keep a copy? Mm-hmm. That's him, you know, totally thrown off by that. And I can tell you again, you know, I can kind of go to my experience. Every once in a while, you have a witness that gets up there and says something you just do not anticipate. And part of the job is figure out how to deal with it on the spot. Come up with whatever your, you know, your argument is, or, you know, disarm it somehow. I tell the story, and I know this is not really necessarily the form, but I tried a case, and the plaintiff in the case was a young man, and he was like late middle school when the accident happened. By the time the trial came up, he was in college. He was a straight A student. I was a little concerned that the jury was just going to love this kid and disregard the facts, because the facts were in my favor as far as I was concerned. So I asked him a question, and he gave me an evasive answer. So then I asked the question again, and he gave an evasive answer again. And I said, please listen carefully. And I did it, and I tried to be totally respectful, because it's a young kid in front of the jury, and I don't want to look like a, you know, an older guy bullying a 20-year-old, whatever he was. And he got so frustrated by the fact that I asked the question a third time that he slammed his fist down. And he said, why aren't you listening to me? In a very loud voice. And the judge had to admonish him to calm down. He said, if the attorney does something that's improper, I will correct him. He's just asking you a question. And I thought, I just won this case right there. And my client got up on the stand. And when she was cross-examined, she just fell apart. And I always think of John Belushi and the Blues Brothers, where she was yelling, there were locusts, you know, that it was just terrible. And I thought, wow, she just snatched defeat from the jaws of victory. But it turns out I did win that case. But anyway, it's just things happen that you don't anticipate. And when he did that, that was a happy accident for me. That was a horrible accident for his attorney. When my client fell apart, it was a happy accident for plaintiff's attorney and a horrible thing for me. And then I had to get up on redirect, and I had to try and rehabilitate her, not so much in the actual testimony she was giving, but just the presentation to the jury. I had to figure out a way to make her seem much more reasonable again. And it's not easy to do. That is something where you have to kind of think on the fly and come up with stuff. So when that testimony came out, just the fact that he found a case to eliminate it, you know, that quickly, that shows the level of preparation. That shows that he's got things at his fingertips at all times. So there's definitely some shortcuts that are taken in the presentation of the trial here, but overall I think it's pretty realistic. There's a lot of stuff that goes on that just felt very real and added to the texture of this movie.
The doctors that were either supposed to wind up on the stand or did wind up on the stand, I think all played great performances. Adding into this, because you figure the basis of Frank's case was after he talked to Dr. Gruber? Do I have that right?
Yes.
Yeah. When he talked to Dr. Gruber originally, it was like, why would you not go to trial with this? You're denying them, you know, a slam dunk opportunity. This is ethically the thing. You know, he thinks he's got this star witness that is going to be the centerpiece of his case, and that falls apart. When you've got Dr. Towler, Wesley Addy, I think did a great performance in that piece because of the fact, and I loved the sequence where we had James Mason's character coaching him, you know, and he was working him through the emotions and how to be prepared for, you know, being cross-examined and things like that. I loved those sequences, but the one that I think makes it all come together
is Joe Seneca as Dr. Thompson. I thought when we got him on the stand, you know, they were really trying to make it look like he was an ambulance chaser of sorts, you know, saying, all you kind of do now, you know, at this later stage of your career is you look for the next opportunity to make some money off of this. I love the fact that you're compassionate to that character, because all of his answers came from a standpoint of, I'm doing this because I believe in it ethically. Yes, I do get paid to be on the stand in these scenarios, but there is a lot of wrong out there. And I believe when he was saying that, he was being genuine. That's the sign of a great performance, when it is a character that, yes, he does not have the same level of credentialing and schooling of some of the other professionals that we saw in the film, but he came with life experiences because they, and I'm glad that they skewed him towards the later end of his career, where it's like, yeah, I get what you're saying, but I'm 74, seen a lot. I'm coming to you with years of experience off of this. And I loved in the cross-examination, you're getting mad at the other side, because it's like, show this man some respect. And yet they were right in what they were doing, because what you're trying to do is diminish the impact of his testimony so you can win your case. I loved that drama that was going on with him, that compassionate wise, if you're watching this, you feel like, why are they beating up this man? But yet it feels real and it feels what you should be doing. Performances in this like that, we talk about the depth of casting. It was not just the main players. It was every single person that was a part of this was so well cast and so knew their roles and who the character was and emotionally what they brought to the table. It was a big tapestry in this. Nobody was a weak link. I did not feel that there, and maybe you feel differently than I do, I did not feel that any of the casting anywhere, from the smallest character straight on through the main players, there was nobody that was misplaced. There was nobody that, like, I wish this person wasn't in there and they found somebody else for that role. Usually in every film, there's somebody I can pick out and go, oh, they were good, but like I think somebody else could have done something different with that. There was none of that in this. Like it was pretty perfect as far as casting. There was nobody that was a standout for me that, like, I was like, that one was just okay. That's hard to do in a film, because this is pretty cast heavy, in the sense that when you're talking about James Mason's team in particular, you need those roles to be right too. You need to feel it's a polished team. Or in the case of some of the newbies, that he is directing them on how to be that polished person. Because we had that in this too. And I felt like those nuances added a reality as well, that not everybody's going to be as seasoned with them. Some of them need his guidance because he's that guy that is managing everybody. And I thought those were great choices in this as well, and added a sense of, this is fully realized. It's not a tunnel. And that part was, I thought, very, very well done in this. You mentioned the script, and I think there's a great marriage between a solid script and amazing acting. And I think it all goes together in this one to make it a special film.
I took a couple of points from that, and I agree with everything that you said. When he's prepping Dr. Tower?
Towler.
Excuse me. It's interesting because it starts off with he takes care of any ethical issue right there, because he starts off with tell him the truth. Mm-hmm. So he's covering his ass there, but then he follows up by basically testifying for him. You did this and you did this and you did this. So he's telling him what to say, even though he's telling him to tell the truth. And he's never saying, I have a routine when I'm prepping a witness, and I always start off with tell the truth. And then at some point I say, understand that if I say something to you and it's not true, it's not because I want you to lie. It's because I'm misunderstanding what the truth is. Mm-hmm. So if I say something that's incorrect, please correct me.
Yeah.
Now, he never said that. But, you know, I do think he covered himself ethically by saying tell the truth. Mm-hmm. I found Joe Seneca's performance and placement in the film to be very interesting, because they dismiss him for the reasons that you say, and because yes. he's a black man. And I love James Mason's response to that too, is, I'll tell you how to deal with that. You don't touch it. You leave it alone. But let's have a black guy at the table with us.
That was great.
That was great. Despite the fact that his credentials are not as impressive as they might be, he comes off as very professorial. When they say something and it's not right, and he just sits there shaking his head, and then he explains to them in layman's terms that everybody can understand why they're wrong, that's all great. Mm-hmm. Then he gets railroaded into saying there was no negligence. And I think the jury would see that the judge is railroading him there, the way that the judge did it. And I also love the judge, if you're going to try my case for me, please don't lose it. I thought that was all great. Paul Newman kind of turns the tables on that as well, because he knows that there was the 1 hour delay and not 9 hours. So when he has Dr. Towler on the stand, he says, well, if you were to do this after only 1 hour, that would be negligence. And the doctor, that would be criminally negligent. You know, he set the trap there, and the doctor walked right into it.
He used his book too, because the book was referenced so much earlier. You know, as being that yes. he's scholarly, and you know, and the quality of the binding of the book. You know, you're seeing that this is clearly a medical journal, and you know, but I loved that he went back to that. He's like, all right, you used that on me before. Let's play with that now.
that's the way to do it.
Yes, it was great.
That's like I said, you know, a lot of this stuff feels very realistic. That's exactly how you would do this in a real trial. I don't know what Mamet's experience is, and the author of the book that this is based on, and then, you know, I should probably be giving the credit to him. He apparently is, or was, I have no idea if he's still around, an attorney. Mm-hmm. So he wrote a lot of this, I'm sure, based on his own personal experiences and things that he saw over the years. So there is a very realistic element to the way the trials presented, and that whole aspect of it, that cross-examination of Dr. Towler and the way he set the trap for him and the doctor walked right into it, that is extremely realistic. But he also turned the tables, because they got Joe Seneca to say that there is no negligence in that very limited capacity, and then he got Dr. Towler to say, yes, that would be criminally negligent. So perfect symmetry there. You were talking earlier about the sound in this movie, and I think the sound, the things that are going on in the sound, as opposed to a soundtrack, mm-hmm. Is excellent. The soundtrack itself, the music that was in it, which was limited, mm-hmm. I wasn't that crazy about it. I didn't think it really emphasized things. I kind of felt, and I don't know if this would work or not, and it'd be kind of one of those things you'd have to kind of see if it fit. But I kind of felt that this movie might have done well with a soundtrack of almost like a very, very light jazz piano. Nothing too fast, just kind of like in the background, a little sound going on once in a while. Excuse me. But I think that might have just given more of an atmospheric feel, as opposed to, you know, totally underlining things.
I think one of the things that was a strength of this for me was the lack of a soundtrack in this. And I think the reason why is, in real life, when this is really going on, and I think it's a bold choice because we're talking about a movie. So actually, you're scoring it, I think, works. So it's not me disputing you. It's more what I liked about the choice in this was leaving it out in so many places in this. I think let this feel like the real world. Because here's the thing, you and I are right now doing a podcast. What we don't have behind us is a score.
Well, maybe we need one. Maybe we need one.
There's times when we do.
But I'm not saying to add a significant amount more of music. Mm-hmm. I'm mm-hmm. just saying the areas where they had music, it almost felt sure. a little too dramatic, if you will.
It almost jumped out at me
a little too much.
I feel this is a film that benefited from less is more. You know, I mean, the fact that they did not do it,
And the I'm with you, actually. I would go more subtle. I'm sorry, and I misunderstood you. So I'm going to backtrack and go, I agree with you 1,000%. I feel the more subtle the music was, the more realistic and grounded this film felt to me. I felt that opening with a big opening number, you know, leading in, was grounded. It felt real.
Well, you hear the pinball machine at the beginning. That's all you hear. And that's yes. Great. And at the end, you just hear the phone, and that's it.
And I think we're saying very similar things, because I feel like the sound in this one was sound effects in a real-world environment, was not music. And I think you're right. Any of the areas where they did, you almost need to go a little more subtle and keep it a little bit more mood, so that way you're not getting in the way of, I think, that atmosphere building that was there. And that's what I think I'm being more protective of. I loved the lack of it in this. And I don't talk about it a lot on this because, I think we've had Scott on before. Scott's much more of a soundtrack expert than I am as far as articulating it. And I think you are too, much more than I am. I love soundtracks though, in the sense that if you go on my phone right now, my playlists, because when I read books, when I read comics, I'm a big comic fan, I will often play music in the background, and it's instrumental, and it's all from films, and it's not all superhero films. I want to be very, very clear. I love movie soundtracks. I am not a music expert by any stretch. I just know what I like. So I have diverse tastes. So I have a vast array of musical soundtracks that, based on my mood and what I'm reading, I like to play. This one, it's weird for me to acknowledge the fact that what I loved about this film was the lack of it. Because I just think this film benefited from sound in the way that you're describing it, the pinball machine. The pinball machine was the perfect opening. That was his escape. And for us, it set the tone of we're hearing what he's hearing. This is when he shut everybody off and he is in. And we see, you're right. You said bookending earlier, and boy, am I keying in on, I think where you were going with that, at the end, him again, embracing that and us hearing that sound so much more powerful without music in the background, which almost would have been noise. Because we've got to hear what he's hearing. We've got to experience what he's experiencing. And that was, I think, a brilliant and a bold choice when you're used to more of a dynamic soundtrack driving a film of this caliber. And I feel like that was just a very, very strong choice in this lack of it. And I agree with you. Anywhere where there was, make it a little bit more subtle and mood oriented, because of the fact that it's musical soundtracks need to kind of stay out of the way of the real world feel of this.
Yeah, agreed. So to give you an example of like where my mind is on this, to take this to its conclusion, I guess, is when you have a dramatic scene in the movie, and I can't give you a specific, but there was this point where there was something dramatic and there was a little bit of a orchestral thing, you know, dun dun dun, you know, whatever it was. I almost would have preferred like the Lonely Man theme there.
Yeah,
you know, I wanted something. When I say like a jazz piano, I'm not talking about like you know, I'm not talking about the Sting. I'm talking, you know, right, playing ragtime music. I'm talking about something very, very low key, and I think that goes exactly to what you're saying.
I agree with you 1,000%. I think that, and I misunderstood you at first. And as you were explaining it, I'm like, oh no, I couldn't be more in agreement with you that, that would have been perfect. You know, what we didn't talk about that. I think it would be, I think before we wrap up, the victims, or, you know, the family of the victim, James and Roxanne Hart.
Now him, I've seen him in other things. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head, which things I've seen him in. I think on several TV shows over the years that he's played a little part in, and probably some movies as well. And he always stands out to me as being a good actor.
Yes.
I think he really brought his A game to this one. He seems so real to me. When the scene when he confronts Frank about not telling them about the offer, and he's like pushing him, just outstanding. The sister seems so sympathetic, and she's just, you know, clearly he's the one calling the shots in that family. You know, she's a little mousy and whatever, but you know, it's you know, you feel so sorry for her. You know, Frank, you have other tactics, right? You have other tactics. You know, just so good.
I love that it's clear that he's working on two levels. First, he's questioning, like, why he's taking the stand of why haven't you told us anything? But it's also clear that he and his wife are having conversations off screen that we're not seeing, and he's a husband defending his wife. Because she clearly is very, very upset, and he's trying to protect her because there has to be some form of positive resolution to this, because this is a family that's hurting. And they're, you know, recognizing there was 210,000 and you said no. You know, then this could be nothing out of this. There needs to be some form of, you know, this is us that we're trying to, there needs to be something out of this. And we could have settled for that. And I loved the honesty of that, that Frank was not communicating with them and was not doing the pieces that would have perhaps controlled that more. And I loved the honesty of that. It just was
totally unethical. Totally unethical. You get an offer, you are absolutely obligated to advise your clients of it. Even if you represent a client and they tell you beforehand, you know, I don't care if they go for $210,000, I want you to turn it down.
Mm-hmm.
They tell you that before you go into the conference. Then they offer them the $210,000 and he turns it down. He's still following their instructions, but he's still obligated to say, by the way, they did offer what you told me to turn down and I turned it down. He has to keep them updated as to what negotiations are. That's his obligation. So for him to just not say anything and say, you know, we've decided to go to trial, that is so wrong.
And that's what he said. That's what the husband said. And I loved that. I mean, the husband was really like, you know, he was all over him on that. And I loved that that played out. I think that missing from this would have been a huge mistake.
And they don't come off as greedy either. They come up, you know, she's got these expenses to keep her. I think they said it's going to be like $50,000, something along those lines. Plus the sister who's been under such stress because of this, her doctor said she's got to, you know, go somewhere. She has to leave this town and go, I think, somewhere warmer and whatever for her health.
Right.
So, you know, they're not coming off as greedy. They're coming off as just, you know, we're trying to live our lives and you're ruining us.
And this would have covered everything we needed.
Yeah. So I think we need to just touch on Sidney Lumet for a second, too, because, wow, what a career this guy has. And I think he has kind of fallen under the radar of a lot of people. I think when you think of the great directors, I don't know that you necessarily go to Sidney Lumet, but man, you know, he did 12 Angry Men. I'm just looking at him. He's got a huge thing here, Failsafe. With the Anderson Tapes, Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express, Dog Day Afternoon, Network, Prince of the City, Death Trap, which we've covered, The Verdict, you know, just so many great movies. And apparently he was at one point an actor, so he kind of, I think that's what makes him so good at bringing these top performances out of the actors, is because he knows the craft. So just, it is so well done. There's so many things in this movie, so many camera angles, so many transitions, so many points when he chooses to cut it off, or so many points where the acting, and I don't know if it's totally his choice, the actor's choice, or the writer's choice, but there's so many points where the performance is shown through reaction without words. And I just think it's just top notch. Absolutely.
Yes. Yeah. I couldn't agree more. It's especially when you look at this catalog, I was just like, I was like, oh yeah, we're supposed to be talking about this. I was like browsing through the catalog of everything that he's done, and you forget how many things he's been associated with. I mean, it's, and you're right. Not a name. It is not a name you hear very often pop up. So you're absolutely right to point that out, especially with this film being as unique. I think this is a very unique movie.
Yeah, I do too. I just, you know, I think courtroom dramas lend themselves to to drama, you know, to they're very compelling in the movies. And there's a few others I'd like to cover. I'd definitely like to cover A Few Good Men. My Cousin Vinny, which is, you know, the comedy version of it, Anatomy of a Murder, maybe even Judgment at Nuremberg. There's so many different courtroom cases to cover. To Kill a Mockingbird. We can have some fun with courtroom drama, but this one is as good as any of them, I'm going to say. It's just a great movie as far as I'm concerned, and I'm going to just be brief here and just say this movie is Jaws. I think this one flies under the radar when people put together their best movies of all time. I don't think they necessarily go to this, but I think it belongs on a list.
I also went with Jaws on this one, and I watched it a second time to make sure I was Jaws, to be honest with you. Because after my first viewing, I was Jaws, and I'm like, let's watch it again just to make sure that that isn't, you know, just the fresh piece off it. I will add something that I'm kind of a broken record on in this one. For anybody who has, if you're at this stage and you have not watched this movie, you have to, because I think what is special about this film is its structure, its choices, what elements that are traditionally in film, you know, that like the tropes that aren't in this one, that they made more grounded choices with. I think they did some very bold, unique things in this film that are sometimes you feel like you have to take a good story and you have to add that Hollywood pizzazz. And I feel like this does not lean into any of that. The story is everything. Being grounded in reality is everything in this. And I loved that aspect of it. I felt that these were very, very real people in what they were doing. And I lost the actors almost immediately in the film. And I started believing they were the characters. And that is always great when that happens. There's a shorter list of films that are able to consistently do that throughout the entire movie. This did it from the beginning of the movie until the end. There was nothing that jarringly took me out of the story that was being laid out in front of me in both viewings. And that's great when you have this opportunity. This makes it a special movie. And I think that should be a caveat for a movie that falls in the Jaws category. It's that special thing that manages to just nail all of the elements. And I think this one really did.
And I think what you're saying is even more surprising when you factor in that you have Paul Newman, Jack Warden, and James Mason, who are three incredibly recognizable actors in this movie, and yet you still can lose yourself in their performances.
Yes.
I think that speaks volumes. So I enjoyed watching this. I enjoyed discussing it, and I hope our audience is of a similar mind. Thanks for joining me on this, Sean. I appreciate it always. This was fun as always.
Thanks for suggesting it. This was a one that I've wanted to watch for years, and I'm glad that we had the opportunity.
Thank you, everybody, for listening, and we'll see you next time. Bye-bye.
I'm going to write to the board of bar overseers about you today, fella.
You're on your way out. They should have kicked you out in that Lillibridge case. Now, this is it today.
I'm an attorney on trial before the bar representing my client. My client. You open your mouth, you're losing my case for me.
Now listen to me,
Phil. No, you listen to me. All I want on this trial was a fair shake. Okay? Push me into court 5 days early. I lose my star witness, and I can't get a continuance, and I don't care. I'm going up there, I'm going to try it, I'm going to let the jury decide. You know, they told me about you. Said you're a hard ass, you're a defendant's judge. Well, I don't care. I said to hell with it, to hell with it.
Look, Galvin, many years ago...
Come on. Hey, don't give me that shit about you being a lawyer, too. I know about you. You couldn't hack it as a lawyer. You were a bag man for the boys downtown, and you still are. I know about you.
Are you done?
You're damn right I'm done. I'm going to ask for a mistrial. I'm going to request that you disqualify yourself from sitting on this case. I'm going to take a transcript of the trial to the Judicial Conduct Board and ask that they impeach your ass.
You aren't going to get a mistrial, boy. We're going back there this afternoon and we're going to try this case to the end. Now you get out of here before I call a bailiff and have you thrown in jail.